You're listening to The Good, The Bad and The Interesting, a series of conversations about quality with Vasilis van Gemert and an eclectic mix of designers. In this episode, I have a conversation with Jenny Shen. Jenny is an independent UX product designer and a public speaker, a meetup organizer and a mentor for designers, among many other things. One of the things Jenny specializes in is localization. So, of course, we talk about differences in design patterns for different countries. We talk about the highly successful Ladies That UX chapter that she started in Amsterdam, and we discuss in length why it is so successful and why it is needed, among many other things. But as always, we start with the question, what makes a thing good?
What makes the thing good? So my point of view is from the angle of UX design, and by definition, UX design is to solve a problem. So I think something can be considered good, depending on what a thing is, of course, if it does what it's supposed to do, and good is like meeting expectation, but great is like exceeding expectations, And like I said, it depends on what a thing is. And sometimes a thing is good if it achieves a greater purpose than just meeting the expectations of doing what it's supposed to do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so if it's good, so you have, at first you define some sort of expectations. We're supposed to achieve these and these goals. And then when you meet those expectations, it's... okay.
It's good because good, how I read it compared to other adjectives, good is like fine. It's like almost like okay, slightly better than okay.
Okay, yeah. That's interesting. It's so good to see. But so many people have different definitions. Good for some people means excellent. Mm-hmm. But for you, it obviously means fine.
Yeah.
Good enough.
Yeah, good enough, exactly.
Yeah. So then you have really good... and then you have excellent.
Excellent, brilliant, fantastic.
Okay. And what makes a thing fantastic then?
So it should exceed expectations and probably bring more benefits to the context, to the use, to the goal, and probably it also involves a very positive emotion. Like it would be really good. The person using it or being is a good event will be feeling extremely happy or satisfied. And it would be a lot more satisfaction compared to then a thing was good.
Okay. So, and I guess when you go from good to excellent, it gets much more complicated.
I would say it's much harder to design something to be excellent than to be good.
Yeah. Yeah, meeting expectations is probably something you can tick off, but then going the extra mile, and I guess it's also something with considering the context.
Exactly.
It gets more complicated because you think about the impact and you think about external factors maybe, things like that.
Yeah, that's how I see it.
That's very interesting. And... now, one of the things you're specializing in, I mean, you do so much stuff, it's incredible. I guess we can go on for 2 days probably talking about what you're doing. But one of the things that you do and what you talk about a lot, I saw a talk from you on CSS Day a while ago, it's about localization and culture research. So I'm always curious about the outsider look, who live in the Netherlands, and what does... so are there some... so what would make a thing, or are the things that are specifically good for the Netherlands that make a UX experience, a user experience, specifically good for the Netherlands? Are there such things?
Something that makes the experience good in the Netherlands. If... we're talking about good means meeting expectations and being in line with what people actually do, then the good things for the Netherlands is systems or processes, ways that are suitable for how people use it. For example, so I live here for 3 years now, and when we go to when I go to restaurants with like friends, people, and we need to split the bill, and it's really common to use this app called like Tiki. Of course, there's many other variations of it where you can just like send payment requests because you need to split the bill. And having lived in multiple countries, I would say Netherlands is the one where this one is really popular and very commonly used, because in Canada or, you know, in Singapore, it's not as so common to split the bill and precisely to the cent. So I find that interesting. Yeah, like I owe you €4.53. Send me a Tiki. So perhaps this app, the existence of it and how it's meeting the user's need is good in this country. But then if you, if I tell my friend in Singapore, like, hey, send me a, I'll send you a payment request of $3. And they would be like, are you crazy?
So that's a very cultural application. Yeah, it's true. I'm half Greek, so, and in Greece it's the opposite. They will not split the bill. There, people will start fighting at the end. Who is allowed to pay the complete bill? Will pay it. No, I will pay
it. That's the same thing in Taiwan and sometimes like Singapore, depending on the context. But my culture is that just like you said, people fight for the bill. Like, no, I'll take all of it. Don't worry about it, because the person who takes the bill is supposed to be, you know, the one that's more generous and the one that's more sort of have a better, finance to take care of each other.
That's a very good example. So are there? So I think you showed some example of a search page, if I remember correctly. And then there are some differences. I mean, we've seen these differences now between, let's say, more distant cultures like Taiwan and Singapore compared to the Netherlands, and Greece compared to the Netherlands. But are some of the difference maybe tiny, like with Belgium or Germany, countries we often compare ourselves to? Are these big differences you notice because you've been studying this, I guess?
So one of the examples that I give in the talk is that even though certain, say, European countries might be next to each other, in Germany, for example, it is much more common to list out all of the details and everything step by step in a really structured, in a really organized way. And users are just used to seeing much more information, reading much more compared to the neighboring countries. And an instance is that on the website, perhaps something that's suitable, that's like more minimal and with just the bare minimum amount of information, probably would not work in Germany, where the homepage for Germany includes a lot more information. If there's like an e-commerce product page, the description will be much, much more detailed and maybe explaining about the fabric, the origin, like the different color variations and so on.
Yeah. So much more detail and some assurances as well, right? So they, if I remember correctly, they like stamps more.
So it is very common in German e-commerce to have those things called trust badges. So trustshops.de. It's social proof to tell the users that, like, 1,000 people have signed up and they rated a 7 out of 10 or something like that, so they can have more assurance of trusting their money with the company.
Very interesting. So these are relatively small regions, right? And we see there are definitely noticeable differences between doing business in making digital products in Germany compared to the Netherlands, for instance. But what about bigger countries? For instance, I mean, we always talk about China, but would you do this localization in China for China, or would it be more regional within China?
That's a really good question, and it is up to really the company and also if there's business value to localize for each region. Okay. Because so China is a big country, so it's Russia, so it's like United States, and in some people might also think like Germany is a big country, you can also localize per region.
Some would even say that about the Netherlands.
Yeah, it is ultimately depending on what people are or what the companies are wanting to get out of localization. One key benefit is that the users who use a localized product will probably find it more intuitive, find it more easy to use. And if it makes business sense, then I think it may be worth the investment. However, localization is a big, it's a lot of work. It requires a lot of research, studying the cultural characteristics, studying the country, studying the users, researching the users. So I will be very keen to see if a product actually localized to that level, but I haven't really seen that yet.
Okay. But it would be interesting to look at it, because if you take localization to the extreme, I guess you end at individual targeting.
Exactly. That's why I think it's interesting how artificial intelligence is helping us personalize a digital product, that machine learning, it's learning about individual preferences. And even in the same country, in the same region, like people are different. Like, do we need to actually localize and personalize it to be that specific?
Yeah. Because, for instance, if I look at voting maps of how people vote in the Netherlands, at general elections, you see a big difference, for instance, between cities and rural areas. So you could localize for those things as well, I guess.
I don't actually know about that. Can you tell me more about like the difference between cities and rural areas, how they vote?
Well, you could, I mean, if you look at it, I'm generalizing here, but in cities it's more, usually a little bit more social and liberal, and it's a bit more conservative on the in rural areas. Mm-hmm. But it's not 100%, of course. I mean, this is generally speaking. And there's other ways. I was thinking as well, if you look at the United States, which seems to be very polarized, at least politically, would you want to target?
I am confident that the politicians or maybe the people who design a campaign have probably used some type kind of targeting, that if they want to, like they want to target this state, the state and versus that state, they might have different approaches in different political sides and also towards each state. I don't work in politics, I actually don't know, but I always think that makes sense.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense from a success point of view, from a business point of view. Are there ethical sides to that?
Yeah, I was asked about this as well. And I would say it's a really, I think, difficult question to answer.
Of course, ethics are very complex.
Yeah, if we take the user's preferences or like cultural characteristic, but the user does not like it, like they don't want to have a product design just because he or she or they is Dutch or Taiwanese and whatever, then, you know, where does the ethics fall into that? I personally think that I don't actually have an answer about this. In the realm of work that I do, we're experimenting like certain patterns on how the users react to certain patterns. Like if we provide more information, does it make the user feel more assured and more easier to sign up? And how I see it is that we are providing benefits to the user in the way, like what they're looking for. If they're looking for assurance, like credibility in a company, and we have the option to work with TrustShop.de/badge, for example, and put it on our website to give the user assurance that they're looking for, then what's the downside of it?
Mm-hmm. I guess so, yeah.
So that's kind of how I see it. But then, you know, overall, we can get into like personalization, artificial intelligence, customization. Yeah, I am afraid I'm going to like butter out something that's not inappropriate. So
okay, well, doesn't really matter. But I think the ethical question is very difficult. Mm. It's also something that we're speaking about more and more.
Yeah.
But it's not always something that you have to talk about. One of the other things that struck me is that you showed some design patterns that you would suggest for Germany. But if I look at those patterns, I would not suggest them to use over here.
Mm-hmm.
And this is interesting because one of the things that I teach my students are design patterns,
mm-hmm.
and to understand these patterns and to know when to use them. And more I'm starting to doubt if they even exist, mm-hmm. design patterns.
That's an interesting point of view, because in my talk and also like in the cross-cultural UX talk, I kind of advocate for really studying the users and see what works for them, and some design patterns that it's normal in one country or it's very common in one country might not be the same case in another country. However, I do think that most humans, like our fundamental similarities, that we're all humans and psychological patterns do affect us, maybe in different levels. For example, the social proof thing. It actually, funny thing is, even though I am Taiwanese and also like kind of Canadian, the social proof thing does not really work on me.
No.
And no, like if I see like 1,000 people at the bottom, I'm like, okay. Okay, well, good for them. But I know very specifically like what I want. If it does not meet my needs, like they can use all the persuasive patterns, but it's not going to work on me. But I am very, I think in this part, I'm very different. And I also noticed how
Is it maybe because you're an expert on these things and you recognize them?
Maybe. So that's not, that could be a possibility. And then when I also I'm going to go back to the Germany example again, because yeah. I've done a lot of research into that. I think German users are, generally speaking, less inclined to giving to this time pressure compared to, in my research, American users. Because when you go to a landing page that's for American users, it's all like timers and it's all like countdown, it's all like limited time offers. But when I go to when I encounter like a product or a website landing page made by German company, it's like totally different. It's more calm. It's like they are trying to tell you how good their product is with information and some testimonial, but it's not like trying to pressure the user with time.
Uh-huh. So it's convincing on the quality of the product instead of convincing with
the time pressure.
Interesting.
We're going off on a tangent. I think your original question was do design patterns exist?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess what I'm trying to say is the social proof thing, it probably worked for a lot of countries, but there might be some cases when it doesn't. But it's still on a personal level, like me, like I find that it does not work for me, or that it's on a kind of cultural level.
Okay, so design patterns, of course, they do exist,
mm-hmm.
but I guess what you're saying is that you should really, really investigate them if they're appropriate for your target audience or the people you're working for, or depending on very many just things that you have to consider.
Exactly. And also design pattern can also be a little bit more broad, like the way that landing pages are designed, the homepage are designed. If suddenly the user have to scroll instead of top to down, they scroll left to right, then some users might be kind of shocked because that's not really how it works on the internet. Like the sort of the custom is right now is scrolling from top to bottom. So designing with patterns actually mean that we're designing with the user's mental model, because according to how it usually work is scrolling from top to bottom. So I think there are still some benefits to design pattern, but we, like you said, we do have to research if that works for our target audience.
Yeah, and the content that we're working with. I'm at the moment I'm working with blind people, and I see that many of the design patterns that we have been taking for granted over the years, for instance, that we put the navigation on top, they make no sense at all for people who use screen readers. Mm-hmm. And so I'm actually starting to think that maybe we should reconsider some of these things. Mm-hmm. Isn't the navigation, for instance, part of the footer? Or is it that important that it should be on top of every page?
I think that topic, I'm totally like really a newbie when it comes to accessibility design. And I'm thinking that if we're designing for blind people, does it actually matter that there's something on the interface, or can it just be programmed, designed in a way that works for the screen reader? Does it actually need to have an interface?
Yeah, well, it doesn't really need a visual. Well, it can. There's different people who use screen readers, of course. There's also people who use a screen reader to read it out loud while they're looking at it. Mm. It can help for certain other disabilities. But there are people who think, well, maybe we should design separate websites for blind people, for instance, like we used to do with mobile design before we had responsive web design, that we made separate mobile websites. But then there's an ethical question there. Do you want to identify people as disabled?
Right, because like if you're disabled and you go to this website,
you'll get the disabled version.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tricky question.
Exactly. It doesn't sound so nice, is it?
No.
But then in the daily life, we also have situations like, well, take the accessibility path, and this is the accessibility parking spot. Mm-hmm. Or if you're disabled, then go this route. So it's already happening in real life.
Yeah. So you could, of course, add some options, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. An option to remove the navigation from the top and add it to the bottom. Okay. There's lots of work that you do. So I looked at your website, and there's one of the quotes that struck me because there's so many interesting words in it, and that's, "Today I focus on solving difficult UX challenges in the travel, mobile, e-commerce, and SaaS markets." And I'm curious about this. What are the difficult UX challenges at the moment? Are there any global challenges, or are these particular to the clients that you work with?
It's a great question. In travel, I'm just going to point that out because I've been working in travel project over the last few months. I cannot say it's a global challenge, but at least those are the challenges of my clients, is that first of all, like, travel industry is very competitive, and across all of the industries, they are trying to incorporate emerging technologies like machine learning or personalization, blockchain, and whatnot. So first, it's working with emerging technologies, and secondly, because the users' expectations are getting higher and higher, and now that a lot of companies are getting better at providing a good user experience, I would say that for me, the difficult challenge I'm helping the client to solve is how to provide a excellent user experience and not just good, while having these emerging technologies in mind so we can stand out in the competition. And also travel industry specifically, I'm personally very interested to make just the experience a lot easier for travelers. So I think you travel a lot as well. I travel a lot as well. It still takes so much time and effort to go from one place to the other. And it's 2018, and we're still having to go through like tons and tons of different steps. So my goal is to help companies in these industry design excellent user experiences. And I'm personally more interested to design inclusive experiences that kind of work more globally and helping companies get into new markets.
Okay, very interesting. There's some very interesting things you say there. For instance, you use the inclusive, which I think is a term that many people use in different ways.
<Of course. laughs>
So what does inclusive mean in your context?
Inclusive means that it's not exclusive, like whoever wants to use it, whoever might have a need for it, they can use it. And also the product is designed with pretty much everyone in mind, but everyone as in like their target audience. And it's not excluding people because of their age or gender, personal traits or ability and culture and whatnot. It's taking all those human differences into consideration.
Okay, well, I mean, I think that's a wicked problem to solve, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's, I really believe that. It's very, I mean, it's a fantastic and beautiful goal to design for everybody, but I guess it's also very hard.
It is. I can give an example of how I try to design, try my best to design inclusive experiences. So I am, indeed, like I said, I'm working on solving, trying to solve difficult challenges, but I'm doing like kind of one step at a time. Because if we try to push too far, like companies are going to bounce back and people are going to, you know, not going to get it if we make really, really big leaps. So I'm doing it like one tiny step at a time. In one project I work with, we were designing like forms, for example. Designing the payment form, designing the forms where users can filling in their names. And to do inclusive design in my way is to consider what are the names people can possibly have and how to design like error messages so that we are not telling users who have like a sort of a, you know, different name with dash, like my name, and give them a warning like, no, you cannot enter a name with dash, enter something else. Yeah. Then people with names are not, you know, I don't know how to say it better, but like normal Latin letters, like we just feel like, okay, what's wrong with my name? Like, why can I not enter it in the form? So that's kind of like my tiny, tiny effort towards designing for inclusion. And another one is just to tell the client about, in some countries, like names could be long and there might be like difference in the order of first name, last name, or maybe different terms. It's just to advocate that there are differences. And I advise the client that if you want to target multiple markets, which you seem like you want to, then do keep this in mind.
Yeah, I really like the detail here that you said, designing the error messages. I think that's something that is forgotten so often. I think Vitaly Friedman did a talk at CSS Day as well, where he said that he started the redesign of the new Smashing magazine with designing the error messages. That was the starting point of the complete redesign. I think that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course names, that's one of the most complicated things out there.
For sure, I looked into it. I looked at the possibility of different name combination, and it's like more complicated than I thought. So my definition of inclusive design is at least the bare minimum to not upset a user because they have a long name, because they have a short name, or because they have a dash or, you know, some apostrophe in their name.
Yeah.
That's like the bare minimum we can do.
Yeah, really good. Yeah, nice example. Yeah, simple but nice. And some of the other bigger issues, for instance, years ago before I became a lecturer, I used to work with big Dutch what are they called? Well, KLM and Transavia, things like that. And one of them was looking into streamlining the different flows of where their visitors came from so that they always knew, okay, that they could always give them a good starting point, which I thought was a very wicked problem as well. So trying to get a map of where do all the people come from social media, from email campaigns, from search engines, or just from the homepage, and how do you So what does the website look like when they enter from different regions? And another one, a big one, I think, was another one which had, they changed from airplane first to digital first, where they said the airplane is not the, well, that's, of course, pretty important of what we do, but most of the people will most of the time be in our digital environments. And that's the first a place where they will meet us. So they switched to digital first design. These, I think there are some big UX challenges there.
Yeah, of course.
Do you work on some of those issues as well, or is it more on the
on the small things currently? Currently, if anyone want have a difficult challenge, feel free to come to me. I am very looking forward to having those difficult challenges.
Okay, looking forward to these kinds of things. Okay, good. I heard you talk about emerging technologies. What are the emerging technologies at this moment you think that we should investigate further? What are the things that people will be using in the near future or start using already?
I think the blockchain topic is really hot. It's so hot that people are putting blockchain in things that don't really make sense.
Okay, yeah.
And I'm very interested to see the, how that will turn out, because having those smart contracts, and not talking about just cryptocurrency, but like smart contract, can probably really change the way, shape the way of how digital products currently are. So I think blockchain is one interesting thing. I'm also quite interested in AR. I'm more interested in AR than VR, because having just a phone as a device and being able to like read and work with the environment with AR, I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. I think so as well. So, for instance, with what's it called, Pokemon Go, that was a sort of an AR where you saw. I remember that a few years ago, I used to do this a lot with my kid, and then we were in a park in a town in the Netherlands, and we were, a year later we were there again, and we thought, when we were walking around there, last time we were in this park, there were all these animals here. What were these animals? And we remembered the animals in the location, but these were Pokemon Go's on our phone. So I think AR is really something that it is very interesting as well. And do you use any of that? Do you know any examples of how that's used in travel? Or
In travel, not AR specifically, but I do know some ideas. I just can't remember the names of the companies. They want to help travelers understand more of like of their context, or if they see a picture and be able to know like what, where's this place and like what is this item. Or when they travel, for example, they can just in their surrounding like get information overlaying the current landscape, like telling them what building it is or what route. Whatever. So that's in travel.
Okay,
What else? I was going to say something, but I totally forgot. I blanked.
Yeah, I think there's lots of things happening there as well in the indoor navigation.
Yeah.
Another thing you do is the Ladies That UX. You started the chapter of Ladies That UX in Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, of course. So Ladies at UX is a global organization, and the mission is to promote female talent in UX, in tech, just so that we can have diverse voices, especially when we see leaderboards or leaders, board members or conferences and speakers, and they tend to be primarily one type of profile. So we want to change that, and we also want to provide women a safe space to discuss their struggles, discuss how it is to be a woman in tech, how to promote themselves, how to negotiate. So that's our goal. In 2015, when I moved to Amsterdam, I started the Amsterdam chapter, and that's just I just did it myself. And luckily, afterwards, I was able to have more team members to join me. And right now, I'm not involved in the Amsterdam chapter anymore since a few months ago. And the community has currently grown to more than 2,000 members.
Wow. That's incredible. That's fantastic, isn't
it? It's unbelievable. I would have never imagined it to get bigger than like 600 people.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's really, really interesting. So that's 2,000 people. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't really realize that the UX industry is that big in Amsterdam, but of course it is, yeah.
It is. It is pretty big. The biggest UX meetup in Amsterdam has about 3,000 people.
Wow.
And so we are 2,000, and some people have overlap. So I think the UX industry is probably kind of about the size, or maybe including folks who are not on Meetup, probably even bigger.
Yeah. So I think one of the things that's, of course, the one of the reasons why it started is that in influential industries like tech and in leadership positions, you see that women are far underrepresented.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, and I know in technology that's true. Is that in design, is that the same as well?
In design, it is the same as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I can also talk about why and what kind of got me to start the Ladies UX Amsterdam. So when I moved here in January 2015, I was trying to know more people, trying to learn and going to meetups and events and whatnot. I've been to a lot of different kinds of meetups, like the ones where I hear talks or drinks. And after a while, like after a few months, and I kind of realized that I was, most of the time, I was one of the handful of women, like, you know, you can count them with two hands, in the meetup. And there was even one event with 80 people, like the room was full, and I looked around the room and I realized I was one of the only, like, one of the five women in the room. So I was thinking to myself, like, is this like the UX community in Amsterdam? Like, where are all the women? Like, why are there more women in these events? That's why I decided to start Ladies UX Amsterdam. I mean, while it's cool to network in those events, I still feel that the underrepresentation kind of bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to change that. I wanted to know, first, are there just not female UXer in Amsterdam?
Yeah, that's an interesting question.
Or are there some, but they just don't go to the meetup? Mm-hmm, and if yes, then why don't they go to the meetup?
And what is it? Which one is it? I guess there are definitely UX designers, women UX designers. The proof is over 2,000 members of Ladies at UX. Are the meetups unwelcome?
So I think from the research, I mean, I haven't interviewed every single person that joined, but people who joined tell me that, especially the ladies who joined, tell me that it's really nice to be able to socialize with other women. We didn't specifically like ask like, oh, why don't you like to go other meetups? We didn't kind of ask that. But my personal experience is that people prefer our event because we have this welcoming, very inclusive vibe. And our chapter, our meetup is not only open to ladies, we are actually welcoming everyone. And we also encourage men to bring their female colleagues, bring their, you know, partners and whatnot, because we want everyone to hear about the amazing work that these UX ladies have done. And we are talking a lot about inclusion and diversity in our meetups.
Yeah. And is it, is this something that's improving? Do you know if we're
we have to silence the tap, which
is
making some gurgling noises. That's not us.
No.
If you're listening to this podcast, so is this improving? Do you know that, or is it a very hard struggle that we have to keep on putting much effort in to keep it going?
So I can give an answer, and I think I might be biased or overly confident, but from what I see, the difference of before Ladies UX Amsterdam started and after, I can see that other meetups started to have more female speakers, and also I started to see more and more female attendees in other meetups, and also conferences start to have more female speakers. I don't know why, or maybe something else has changed, but I was one day, I was actually looking at just out of curiosity, like I wanted to know the other meetups, how many female speakers do they invite? And other events, how many female speakers, how many event attendees? So I was just browsing like multiple UX and tech meetups by looking at photos, by also looking at the speakers' names. Before 2015, like October, there were really not that many women.
No.
And afterwards, I started to see more women in pictures and started to see more female speakers, and a lot of them come from the ladies UX community. Mm-hmm. So kind of one of the assumptions is that maybe nobody gave them a platform to speak, because meetup organizers work in different ways. Sometimes they get referrals, sometimes they reach out to speakers, but if the organizer don't know any female speakers, they will never be contacted to speak, because it's less likely that, and generalizing again, but it's less likely that they will be more proactive and just send to meetup organizer, hey, can I speak at your meetup? That's not really common.
It is something that you do, though.
Yeah. So I think I'm a bit different.
That's good. We learn from different people. I mean,
yeah.
Sameness is not interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I just have no shame. I just reach out if I think I can be of help. I can share my knowledge, and I just reach out.
Yeah, if I read it correctly, you said a few years ago, I want to speak at one conference at the end of this year, mm-hmm. and you spoke at four conferences.
Yeah,
and now I think you're traveling all day, all week, all year around the world to speak at conferences.
Yeah, that was really amazing. So that one year I wanted to speak at one conference was last year.
Yeah.
It was last year. I set up a goal to to speak at one conference. I end up speaking at four. And this year, I think so far, this year, just counting my conference list, I'm doing 18.
That's fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
So more people should do that. More women. Mm-hmm.
I really hope so. Yeah. And it could be a lot of reasons why people, including women, don't feel comfortable reaching out. Like some people don't know what to talk about. Mm-hmm. Some people don't know how they should talk about it. Some people also just feel uncomfortable to reach out and they prefer to be contacted. And you would be surprised when we contact speakers in Ladies UX Amsterdam, we still get turned down. They said, oh no, like I'm not the most qualified to speak on this topic. I don't have enough experience, but you should contact this person. And sometimes it's a male. And we're like, oh, but we are trying to have more representation. But we would like to really help you to formulate a topic. We can help you rehearse. I can give you feedback. And some people end up taking the offer and some people did not. So even if our goal is to have more female speaker for more better representation, it is still challenging. It's not as easy as people think.
No. Okay, that's interesting. So if they want to, one of the things, so if people want to start speaking but they feel uncomfortable, one of the things they can do is contact you, right? One of the other things that you do is you do mentoring.
Yeah, that's true. They can contact me or they can read this blog post that you just mentioned. It talks about why I want to speak and how I got started speaking, how I planned my first talk, really.
Yeah.
And some people have messaged me and said that post really inspired them to mm-hmm. start speaking. And when I get these kind of messages, especially from women, I am super, super happy. And yeah, so I do mentoring. And some of the things I also help mentees, if this is their goal, is to get into public speaking.
Yeah. Okay, good. And why is it important? I mean, I guess not everybody knows that.
Mm-hmm.
But why is it so important that more women speak at conferences, that we see more women at these places?
Yes, very good question. Diverse voices, hearing from diverse voices can bring different advantages, because if we all hear from just one single profile, that perhaps have a more similar way of thinking or similar company culture, similar line of work, then it's a danger that we are not hearing. We're hearing a single story. But if we hear diverse voices, we can get to know that women or non-binary folks or underrepresented folks, like what is it that they're doing? What challenges are they facing? I think it gives us a better view on what is actually the status of the tech industry and how can we design for people like them? Because if we only hear from one profile, then I think one thing is sure that we all have biases. If we all hear people from one profile, then we might get affected by their design decisions, which we might involve their biases. But if we hear different opinions, then it helps us to, yeah, like I said, have a more holistic understanding of the society in whole, and especially if our target audience are women or non-binary people, or we strive to design for everyone, then wouldn't it make sense to hear from everyone?
Yeah, of course. Another thing I always say is if I look at, for instance, my students, not 50% of the, half of them are women, probably, maybe a little bit less, but about half of them. But if I look at lots of the design agencies, most of the people there are men, and definitely at higher level positions. This is, of course, not very welcoming, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at a all-male company, do you want to work there?
Exactly. And also, so first, that's a thing. If the company is all-male, and if I'm the only... If I'm applying for the job, I have to think about, I have to work with these people all day for, you know, five days a week. Then what are the topics they're going to talk about? How do I fit in? It just feels more difficult. And I actually have been there before. In most of my careers, when I work in a team, I am most of the time the only female in an all-male team. And sometimes, even though people don't say that you're not welcome, it's sort of a voice that feel like, okay, I'm very different. Like, I like to talk about different subjects, or I don't like to drink beer. I don't like to talk about craft beer. I don't even drink alcohol. So these kind of things can hinder somebody from entering a all-male conference, or not all-male, but you get an idea, or all-male work environment. Generally speaking, like I think diverse workplaces, conference lineup or attendees can help people feel more welcome and feel like I belong here, I'm a part of this place.
Yeah. Okay. So you work, I think, mostly remotely. Is that true?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But do you get to make your own teams that you work with? So you get to assemble them?
It depends per client project. So in one of the long-term contracts I have with a client, I was part of a team. And my responsibility is just to work well with the team and sometimes like initiate things within the company. We didn't actually have a need to recruit more people or hire junior designers. And in some other client projects, I am more doing the hands-on work myself. And regarding like recruiting a team, that's not what I'm currently do, but I would like to get involved with that because I've already done a lot of those recruitment things at Ladies UX.
Yeah.
So if a company wants me to recruit a team, kind of educate about design best practices, I'm more than happy to help those clients.
Okay, good. Yeah. So how does that work, working remotely? Because I see you've been working with clients from all over the globe. I guess you work with people who live tomorrow, right? Who are in a time zone that's the next day, things like that. Which I guess can be pretty confusing. Or how does that work?
So like you said, I work with remote work with companies in different time zones. And it is confusing sometimes, but luckily we have a lot of digital tools to help us with that. There are time zone calculators. You can also have different time zones in your Google Calendar. So you can easily find what's the best time for you to meet with somebody in Sydney, for example, or San Francisco. And I've been remote working for about 7 years. And yeah, over time, I just kind of learned to get used to it. And the only thing to watch out, funny thing is, the biggest thing to watch out is not the time zone calculation in in my current time zone versus a very far country, it's like my time zone to compare to like UK or Portugal or some European country, because I kind of forget that there is a time difference.
Yeah, 1 hour.
Yeah, it's like 1 hour before, 1 hour after. And then sometimes when, say, somebody in the UK will say, hey, that's me at 12, and I'll say, okay. And I forget there's a time zone difference. So I'm waiting for them at my 12. And then I'm like, okay, this person is not showing up. But actually, it's 11 their time.
Yeah. So the time zone differences are actually harder when it's close by. That's interesting. Yeah. Never heard that one before. Okay, if I work from home, so you work from home most of the time? Yeah, right here?
Yeah, okay. We're recording the podcast from my home studio, so Vasilis can actually look at, imagine what I'm doing every day in a small desk, small computer.
Yeah, and I get very distracted when I work from home.
Mm-hmm.
So there's other stuff that I can do. There's a whole library with books that I can read. Mm-hmm. There's a garden that I can go to. There's tons of things to procrastinate.
Mm-hmm.
Let's call it that way.
Yeah.
Do you have any tips, anything? Do you have any issues with it? Maybe you don't have that problem at all. Some people just work. But.
Yeah, the procrastination thing. I used to in the beginning, and I think I procrastinate the most when I was moonlighting as a freelancer on the side when I had a full-time job. So it's very tiring to have a 8-hour work day and you come home, you still need to finish a client work at like 7 or 8 p.m. and then work through the night. I tend to procrastinate in those situations, but then when I set aside time, more usually in the daytime, like on the weekends, I find it actually easier if I just tell myself, okay, Saturday, I am, for the morning till noon, I'm going to work on this project and I'm going to deliver to the client whenever I'm done. I find it easier to work in the daytime than the nighttime. And over time, soon after many years, I just developed this self-discipline, which I'm very amazed at myself, because I am really good at procrastinating.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And maybe not having a lot of distraction, being intentional about that is also something that helps, because my home is kind of boring. There's not a lot of things going on.
Yeah, there's not much. That's yeah. Distraction-free
No,
house, yes.
I live in Horpdorp, and like every day I just look outside the window. I have like a very calming view to help me focus. I make a cup of tea. I don't have a lot of noise in my home office, so I can concentrate very well.
Okay.
Good. Yeah, and sometimes like a whole day just pass and I do a lot of work.
Excellent, fantastic. So I work in design education. So I teach part of the next generation of digital product designers how to design digital products. What are the things that future designers need to know? What do they have to know? If it's up to you.
The future designers. I think earlier we talked about the design ethics.
Yeah.
I think it's a really important topic because designers, we design stuff that people actually use, and it can create habits. Sometimes it can create addictions. Sometimes it can kind of generate this loop of maybe even create anxiety with mm-hmm. notifications and kind of a constant habit of checking in their email, checking in their social media and whatnot. So I think that the future designer should be aware of ethics, or at least be interested to learn more about it, learn our role in ethics. Like what is the designer's responsibility in ethics? And maybe if the designer feel like we're responsible, then what can we do to make sure that we don't design product that make people's lives worse, but good for the company?
Yeah, at the same time, right?
Yeah. And so I advocate for diversity and inclusion. So I will say to the future designers, try to learn more about diversity, inclusion, and why diversity and inclusion matters. And if somebody does want to design international product, which are basically products for people around the world, then try to hear from more diverse voices and be mindful in their design that they are not excluding anyone, knowingly or unknowingly.
Very good. And is there a type of attitude that designers should have?
I can't say for everyone, but it, generally speaking, like what I tell my mentees is that designers will be really good if they have a like attitude of being curious. If something works, something doesn't work, be curious to find out like why, how can we make it better instead of just leaving it at that. Also, the industry is constantly like changing and moving really fast. So we do have to be prepared to keep up and also be constantly learning. Like life is just practice lifelong learning and always be interested to hear about the things going that's happening outside of the industry to have a more holistic view. Because if a designer is all they hear about is UX design and whatnot, but we don't hear the business side, we don't hear the marketing side, we don't hear from developers, like what do they care about, how do they work, what matters to them, maybe the reason why they don't like a design pattern is because it affects the speed or something else. But if the designer only kind of have a very single focus on what he or she or they like to learn, then I think it's a danger of not being able to work well with people in other discipline. So
that's important.
Yeah.
Keep a holistic view. Yeah.
Keep a holistic view and try to be more curious in what other disciplines are doing. It's not a bad idea to go to business or marketing or development event just to see what is it that they're actually doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's very interesting. Yeah, I started talking actually at different kinds of events because I always thought that when I went to front-end development conferences, people were saying that what I already knew, but then I said, but my design colleagues don't know this.
Yeah.
Go speak at their conferences.
Yeah.
And then there's, I mean, we talked in the beginning about the good versus excellent. And I guess whenever possible, we should try to achieve excellency instead of just good enough. Is there an attitude that designers should have as well?
I would think so, but only sometimes, yes and no, because I'm a person who practice being like lean and agile and sometimes going after the low-hanging fruit. A lot of designers, the way that we are taught or in courses and university and whatnot is to have a very like thorough design process and you have to follow every single step. And if you don't do a persona, if you don't do a customer journey, then this is not done. So it takes a designer like a few months to actually complete something. But in some cases, being lean and being experimental, I think it's a good thing. So I wouldn't say that designers have to do everything excellent. Also know like when to just do it good, when to do it excellent. And if it's like an idea that's not even validated, why are we spending so much time to perfect it and make it excellent? We don't even know, does anybody need it? Does it solve the problem a lot in a way that they will buy it or whatever? So yeah, there are times where it makes sense to design it good, design it and design it excellently.
That's so interesting. Wow. Thank you so much. That was so interesting. Do you have anything to add to this conversation? Do you want to say a final word to our listeners?
So I want to say it's really great to chat with Vasilis. We cover a lot of topics on ethics, about design. And I'm happy to be able to kind of share my thoughts about the diversity inclusion in case people haven't figured out that's kind of like my main topic and sort of my main mission.
Okay, excellent. So if you're looking for anybody on these topics that we discussed and many more, I guess, get in contact. And also for mentoring, I thought, let's talk about mentoring a little bit more.
Okay,
I think
sure.
That's very interesting what you're doing there. So you said you mentor UX professionals, right? And students as well, or?
Yeah, the people that I mentor are not necessarily professionals. Like, well, not UX. They are not saying they are not professional, but they are not yet UX professional.
Ah, okay.
I mentor people who either want to get into UX or they already are learning UX, but they need a clear next step in their career or in their portfolio. And I also help people who are already practicing UX how to get to the next level. So I basically help these three different type of people in different places of their career.
Okay, and how does that work? So they contact you and then...
Yeah, so they contact me. I have a website set up where people can read about what a mentorship program is about, how I work, social proof, of course. And then they will fill out the form for me to understand what have been their experience so far, like why are they getting to UX and what is your goal and what they are looking to get out of a mentorship. Then I select the mentees based on who I think I could be a good mentor for, because sometimes people have different mentoring styles, and it actually does take time to find a mentee that's working well with your style. Mm-hmm. And then, so after a mentee is selected, I have a strategy call with each mentee. I try to understand more in detail about their career goal, understand where they are right now and where they want to get to. Some people have very ambitious goals, like they want to get into a UX consultancy and they already have their dream companies and roles in mind. Then I lay out like a plan for them, like, okay, well, you right now you're here, your long-term goal is here, in the middle there is these steps, so we have to get through one by one. And most of the time it involves improving their portfolio to speak to an employer, and or also working on a self-initiated project to improve their experience. And it's, a lot of time it also involves practicing interviews, design exercises, resume writing, cover letter writing, and yeah, all of the things that can help a person advance in their career.
Fantastic. Wow. That's really good, really good. Really, more people should do that. I mean, this mentor, I guess that it really helps.
Yeah, and especially like happy when people have come back to me and tell me that they got a dream role that they're looking for, or they got their first freelance clients. Aside from all the career thing that I do, I also help people get more familiar and practice like remote work and also freelancing. Okay. I have helped mentees who actually just graduated out of General Assembly, like help her with her full-time job and freelance job. So they're actually doing a lot of things, kind of like mimicking what I do basically, but I think it's wonderful.
Okay, really good. Wow. Well, thank you very much again for this wonderful conversation.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you so much.
This was episode number 64 of The Good, The Bad and The Interesting with Vasilis van Gemert, that's me, and Jenny Shen. If you feel the urge to give any feedback, you are more than welcome. If you want to get in contact with Jenny, you can find her contact details on her website. You can send me an email via vasilis@vasilis.nl. Or if your feedback fits in a tweet, you can find me on Twitter at @vasilis. Another thing you can do is helping me pay the bills for the transcripts of this podcast. These transcripts are necessary for those of us who can't or who don't want to listen. They're handy for robots or people who want to analyze the contents of these conversations as well. Support can be done in many ways, and they all make me very happy. You can find all options on vasilis.nl/support, like Patreon, direct money transfer, or a virtual cup of coffee. A steadily growing list of wonderful people are donating regularly, like Paul van Buren, Job, and my employer CMD in Amsterdam. I have no idea when the next episode is going to be recorded and with whom it will be. I am a bit busy with other things at the moment. It could take a while. I hope you don't mind too much.